Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with my Science Hour for May 30th, 2024. And first, I'm going to pick up on a couple topics I did not get into last week's show. In 2003, let me see, something like that, 2002, 2003, that time frame, I came out with my second book, actually the third. The first book was Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes. The second one was actually kind of, I call it a pamphlet, 60 pages, in a smaller format called Surviving Planet X Passage. And that was to discuss, the primary reason was to talk about literally how to survive a Planet X Passage. That's what it was about. And one of the core issues there was how to build a calendar out of a pile of rocks, a calendar and a clock, so that if there were a pole shift, you would be able to recalendar. And so that was a very interesting thing. And there were people, I got feedback that people put that into their vault. There were these people that have a safe vault that nothing could damage. And in there would be a copy in a plastic bag of my book because it was so fundamental. And after that book came out, we started finding all around the world these piles of rock with this calendar built the way I talked about it. And it was essential because, you know, what, number one, it shows that the people had knowledge of astronomy, how to tell or create a clock and a calendar using astronomy. Okay, so anyway, that's not the point. My third book, or the second book, if you count that second one as a pamphlet, was called Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection. And in terms of sales of my book and the effect on the public, one of my good friends said that I created more employment with that book than any other because in that time everybody was talking about Planet X. But what I did is those topics of Atlantis, of Tesla, and the Colburn, which was new. I mean, I introduced the Colburn into the Western Hemisphere with that book, and it just exploded. I was on Coast to Coast that night, Coast to Coast AM, and George Norrie, it had pre-sold, actually, because the title had not been announced, but I had pre-sold a lot of copies, let's say. And as soon as George Norrie read the title on the air, the web page went crazy. I sold over $50,000 worth of books that night. I think there was maybe 8,000 pre-sale and then $42,000 in about 6 hours. In my, at the time, my limit on my merchant processing was $5,000. This is back in the early days of internet purchasing, etc. And my merchant account shut down. They said, you have to, they thought I was pulling a scam. And so they said, what is this? What are you selling? What did you do? I said, well, I wrote a book and it sold, you know, to, beyond my wildest expectations. And back in 2003, $50,000 in a night was a pretty good deal. You know, that was doing quite well. And so anyway, I had to print and ship the books and show that I had sent the books to all these customers to show that it was a real deal, you know, and I did, and then the merchant account paid me. But in that book, I breached many new topics, including where Atlantis is. Now, you still see all over YouTube, all over Atlanta, oh, Atlanta discovered. You know, and they put it in, you know, the middle of the Sahara Desert or up, who knows where. But the real location of Atlantis, which was discovered and was actually being excavated, is in the South China Sea. That was not my discovery. My discovery was that the Navy was actually in the South China Sea at the time with submarines, excavating Atlantis with divers. It's very shallow there. It's very shallow. But they found the mother city of Atlantis, which sank into the ocean. And the one of the famous aspects of Atlantis, it was surrounded by bogs. And now you may have seen, if you've been any place on the internet, that they're talking about this Eye of the Sahara being Atlantis. And there's a lot of interesting indicators, but one of the big ones that is not there are the bogs that surrounded Atlantis. Atlantis had like rice, or what? Not really rice, but like reed bogs, which can grow on the ocean, and they're actually kind of floating. And they had channels that cut in to these bogs, which were the entrance into Atlantis, and the Pillars of Hercules was Krakatoa and the sister volcano, which were right next door. And they were talking about the Pillars of Hercules being the Rock of Gibraltar. Well, it does not match the Pillars of Hercules at all. And what the Pillars of Hercules were these two massive plumes, volcanic plumes, that came up from Krakatoa. It's in the Sunda Strait at Java. And that was the, for hundreds and hundreds of miles around, whether it was day or night, at night you could see the glow. Even if it was raining, you could see the glow of these volcanoes from a distance. And the mariners would come into that gate and in, and if enemies tried to attack, which they did, Atlantis had like reflective mirrors and electricity where they just burn them out of the water. Because, of course, in those days, all of the ships were wood and cloth and sail ships. So nobody could get near this place that wasn't wanted. If you were a merchant and you came in with your goods, of course, you could come in because they let you come in. So anyway, the bogs around Atlantis are one of the big reasons why this Eye of the Sahara doesn't fit the picture. It's interesting. It's a quirk of maybe a, what would you say it, one of those quirks of nature. The Eye of the Sahara is where a bolt of lightning from a passing comet touched down and formed that ring process. We see this on other moons, like Europa of or Ganymede of Jupiter. The moons have these ring systems. And they're, let me give you an example in physics. Take a wire with a battery connected to it, a DC battery, and a resistor so you don't short circuit the battery, and then put it through a piece of paper, and you get this ring pattern that forms. If you put iron filings on the piece of paper, they will form in these ring patterns, and that's what's going on, where the, so there's iron, there's nickel, metals with magnetic properties in the ground, and when these very large electrical discharges hit from outer space, they form these ring patterns. And I pointed that out in my very early work as an indicator that these large comets would come by and zap, you know, a electrical discharge. And so anyway, that's what the Eye of the Sahara is. And of course, a tremendous amount of heat, so you have a lot of glass there. But it is not the original city of Atlantis. The original city of Atlantis was discovered in the South China Sea. And what I did, and I talked about it in my book, was that the U.S. Navy had a base in northern Australia where they were, that was the base for the submarines, and they would go into the South China Sea. And at the time, there was a great deal of consternation amongst the Chinese, who were very angry about this, but they couldn't do anything about it. They had no navy, they had no military, they really didn't have anything, so the U.S. Navy was free to do whatever they wanted there. And of course, they were clogging up the shipping lanes because it was very shallow there. And the South China Sea is known for these floating bogs. They float up. They create gases from bacteria growing in them, and then they float up to the surface and they cause havoc with shipping. It's one of the world's major shipping lanes, and it causes a lot of problems with commercial ships in that area. So anyway, that fits the story also of Atlantis with these bog, real big bog areas around surrounding Atlantis. Okay, but this is kind of a lead up to what I want to talk about. The question is, what technologies do you need to be an advanced civilization and be spacefaring, literally? And so I answer it in that book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. And by the way, all of this is for sale. Now you can buy my individual books on my webpage, the JMCC SCI webpage, and I have my education package there. I have the books, CDs, everything is downloadable now. Okay, so at any rate, what technologies do you need to be spacefaring? And today, let me just compare this with today. You have NASA. Russia's space program, something I'm very familiar with. In fact, I've done radio shows on this particular topic about the Russian space program. I did a Christmas special back in the day with Art Bell, this is back in the mid-90s, on the Russian space program. Most people have no idea that the Russians are very advanced as far as experience in outer space. In fact, there were decades, even up till recently, when the U.S. depended primarily on Russia to get anything into outer space because we had no rocket capability. Until SpaceX came along, literally, we had no ability to put a mouse into space. Okay, so anyway, but the real question is, the Russians have what you might call more primitive technologies. If they developed a technology back in the 60s, or even in the 50s, back in the Sputnik era, if they developed a technology that worked, they stuck with it. They didn't have to reinvent it. That's the problem with NASA, is every time they send a satellite up, it's got to be a brand new one. Instead of building 100 Voyager-type spacecraft and sending them all over the solar system, no, they built two. And, of course, they're hugely expensive and hugely expensive to maintain. But the Russians, on the other hand, if they built a technology, a good example are their oxygen tanks. Of course, if you're in a space capsule, you need oxygen for the guys to breathe, and you need a lot of it. Then you need a method of converting that oxygen back to the CO2 that the people breathe out. You have to break off the carbon, which is a lot of energy, and then store the oxygen so they can breathe it again. Okay, so the Russians developed these technologies very early on in their space program, and that's why they had people in space for like a year, back in the 60s. Yeah, they had space stations back in the 60s, and we had nothing. We were just waiting 6 or 8 or 10 months for maybe longer, a year, for a launch, the next shuttle launch. And then they had the accident, and then it was longer. And oh, my goodness. And all this time, the Russians were going into space 2, 3, 10 people every day, every day. But the oxygen tanks they had were a round tank with a valve on it. And so if they needed more oxygen, they just opened the valve. That was it. That was Russian technology, whereas the United States needed electronics and technology and transistor, you know, everything remote controlled from Houston, and, you know, with sensors and backup redundant sensors. No, the Russians had a tank with a valve on it. Do you need more oxygen? Open the valve, you know. And so the Russians have a very simplistic way of looking at space. Plus, it's very reliable. Just think of all of those things you don't have to depend on. The guy just opens the valve. That's it. There's a joke about the NASA spent millions and millions of dollars to develop a pen that would write in outer space because there's no gravity. When you write with a ballpoint pen or any kind of pen, gravity is pulling the ink down to the tip. Where you're, you know, and when there's no more ink, well, then the tube is dry, or the quiver, the quill, the old quill pens that were from a feather of a bird, the same thing. Gravity would pull the ink down. Well, if you don't have gravity, a ballpoint pen doesn't work. And so you needed a pen in space to write in zero gravity. Well, The NASA spent millions and millions of dollars to develop this pen that would write in outer space. And the Russians used a pencil. That's the difference. That's the mentality, the difference between the West, where you can throw vast amounts of money at something that is totally unnecessary. The idea is then in space, keep it simple. Okay, so at any rate, the question is, getting back to my original question, what technologies do you really need to go into outer space? And as I said, I answered this in my Atlantis to Tesla book. And you only need two things. You need glass technology, and you need, and it would help to have quartz technology too, which is fairly easy, growing quartz in quartz crystals, or for example, with my ultraviolet sterilizer that I sell with my water filter package with the MR5, there's a quartz sleeve that is, and it's pretty tough stuff. Sometimes in shipping, the UV bulbs will break. You know, they get banged around, but very, very, very rarely do the quartz tubes get broken. And, you know, when UPS or the post office handles stuff, it's like really, really bad news. They really bounce those packages around. If it's made out of glass, it's going to break. So you have to be really, really very careful packaging things so they don't break in shipping. But the quartz tubes are pretty resilient. They can kind of get banged around a little bit, and they still are okay. Okay, so that would help too, and that's something that is not very difficult to do, is to have quartz tubing. It's much more resilient than glass. Although hardened glass, we have glass today, you know, like windows on cars that are extremely resilient, very tough stuff. Okay, so you need glass. The other thing you need is metal. And these are typically soft metals like copper, aluminum, because we use aluminum for cabling. If you get into higher currents and things like that, then copper is a better transmitter of electricity than aluminum. But aluminum is cheap and more plentiful. And so a lot of times you'll find aluminum wire as a cheaper form of wire. Okay, the other thing is gold. Gold is used in electronics. And it's a soft metal. It's pliable, it's malleable, and you can put it, you can make it in any shape. And if you form a glass tube or a glass jar or whatever for electricity, or a vacuum tube, and you put a wire through it, the glass will form around there like a perfect seal. And so you have like the old tubes. When I was in college back in the 60s, when I first started electronics, we had tubes. And the transistors were a little can. It was literally called a can. And it had semiconductor material in there and three little leads coming out of it. And that was a transistor, and the diodes had two little leads coming out of it. And then, of course, everything got miniaturized and printed circuit boards. You know, and I watched this technology develop literally from tubes. Back in the World War II days, you had tubes. You had diodes and triodes and all kinds of electronic devices that were made with tubes. But those tubes were a vacuum tube many times, because the metal does not oxidize when you heat it up in a vacuum. And that's was the trick, of course, in making the light bulb, the incandescent light bulb, the Edison light bulb, was that you could get metal wires to go into the glass. And when the glass solidified, it made a perfect vacuum seal around the wire. So those are technologies that are needed, and that's all you need. You do not need anything else. And what I'm talking about is the propulsion system. So if you wanted to make, for example, a spacecraft, you could make a spacecraft out of, say, a quartz material, which would be the equivalent of, say, carbon fiber today. There's other types of materials that would be very strong. And you could even use wood because wood was used, for example, extensively by most countries in World War II, for example, to make airframes. The de Havilland, what was it, the Mosquito, was one of the famous ones built in England. I believe the Mosquito was a aircraft that was built in England. And purely wood, plywood, balsa wood, very lightweight, big powerful engine, and these things they were the highest performance. They could do all kinds of things, and they didn't put armor on them because they were so fast that nobody could catch them. That if they got in a dogfight, they just step on the gas and they were out of there. And so they didn't have to have a lot of armor. They were not engaged typically. They did occasionally get shot down, but they could go hundreds of miles an hour faster than any other available aircraft, but made out of plywood. So what is plywood? It's very thin layers of wood. And I don't know if you've ever seen one of these rollers where they take a log, and it might be a log of birch, or it might be aspen, or it might be pine, or it could be hardwoods like oak or birch or something like that. But anyway, it's a big long blade. It's a blade that is as wide as your material for the plywood, and it slowly works inwards, and what comes off is a very thin sheet of wood. And then you layer these up with the grains going crossways to each other every other layer. And that's you put glue in there, you impregnate it with glue, a glue that's completely saturated in the wood, and then you put this together and it makes this really strong material, extremely strong. Plywood is very strong. And of course now they have fiberboard with chips where the wood is compressed and impregnated with a glue. It's mainly glue with fiber from the wood. But anyway, you could make spacecraft basically out of plywood. These are technologies that are very available to primitive societies. Now, you've heard about the flying carpets. They talk about these in the Middle East. For example, the people would get on a flying carpet. And literally, what we think of today is Aladdin, getting on his flying carpet and going someplace. But what they really were a spacecraft, a type of spacecraft. And imagine, let me just give you an example here. And today, more and more, if you look up on the internet, people are going back to dirigibles. What is a dirigible? Or hot air balloons, that's another type. If you have a structure that's very lightweight, and I'm talking about, say, balsa plywood, and Atlantis would have had, just remember, they would have had access to resources from around the world. They had a huge navy. The Phoenicians that we talk about in ancient history, it's the most ancient mariners we know of in our modern history comes from the Phoenicians. The Peary Reese map that Columbus had was derived from Phoenician maps, and that's why it had the coast of South America, not, I'm sorry, the coast of Antarctica very well laid out, and only was verified with satellites that could see through the ice. That had visibility through the ice that's there now, because at that time the Antarctica was in a different position. It was a moderately temperate climate continent, and the pole shift that occurred during the Venus event changed that, and that's why the land surface of Antarctica is warm. That's why the ice sheets are sliding off of it. Because it's warm. That's why there Lake Vostok is a huge lake. It's like half the it's like the size of Lake Superior under the ice. How does that work if Antarctica is all this, hundreds of millions, billions of years old? It doesn't make any sense. It's very recently was put into that position because of a pole shift. Okay, so anyway, the Phoenicians are the derivative of the Atlantean mariners. Okay, so anyway, they had access, my point is, they had access to the world resources, including balsa wood. So they had the ability to make balsa structures, very lightweight, and then also cloth, different types of cloth. Look at in the 1800s, they were flying dirigibles. They used what was it, the one that burned up. The company that made these in Germany was called Zeppelin, and the Hindenburg is the one where they had the accident where I think there was wind or something, they were trying to bring it down, and it caught onto some kind of electric pole, it caught on fire and burned. But the surface of that, from what I understand, was goatskins. Now, talk about something that is readily available, as a material. So here you have a major, major construction. There was a metal frame, I think it was aluminum, frame, and then they put this skin over it and then filled it full of hydrogen, and that was the gas of choice at the time to fill these dirigibles, and they were flying all over the world. They would take like a week. They'd go from Germany to, say, Argentina. That was one of the big routes. And that's why Germany had this big presence in, for example, Argentina. So when World War II started, or even World War I, there was a lot of traffic between Germany and Argentina. And a lot of the people that were in Germany fled and went to Argentina. And that's, I'm not going to get into that whole ball of wax history. Because most of the people that had any kind of money at all were able to get out of Germany and take boats, etc., to other places before World War II ever started. And because they saw the handwriting on the wall. But anyway, I'm really getting off topic here. The point is that with very primitive materials, you could build a dirigible type of structure. And the dirigible, what's the advantage? There are many dirigible type of aircraft coming out today. So they are filled with helium, or helium is more expensive. It's more difficult to get because helium comes from radioactive decay of radioactive materials that are in the ground. And so the supply of helium is very limited, especially to use in those kinds of quantities. So hydrogen was the clear choice, except remember that the problem with the fire of the Hindenburg, from what I understand, was not with the helium, I'm sorry, not with the hydrogen, but with the skin of the aircraft. And oddly enough, people survived that fire. But this was one of the more luxurious ways to travel. These were like hotels strapped to the bottom of these dirigibles, and they were flying all over the world. They would New York to Paris. Berlin to Paris to New York to Argentina to South America. They were connecting the world, and of course the cost of this was quite a bit, but it was also very comfortable. They were low speed, there was no turbulence. You could walk around, you had your hotel room, you had all these amazing meals. This was the lifestyle, and most people forget about that. You look at air travel today, it's really pretty uncomfortable. I mean, you get a tube with 300 people in it, and you're packed in there like sardines. It's not really comfortable. And they don't use any of the technology related to dirigibles, lighter than air aircraft. And so the right today, there are people pursuing that again, where they have a big balloon-shaped aircraft, and they're relatively low speed, but if it's very comfortable, you don't mind being in it for a day or two, maybe getting from New York to Paris, because it's very comfortable. I've been on, 14, 15-hour flights, 10-hour flights, and it's not bad. You just prepare yourself for it. It's like, okay, I'm going to be, and you can get up and walk around, and these are big planes. These are like Airbus, the big ones, or maybe a big Boeing, like 777 or bigger. And you're pretty comfortable. I mean, it's like sitting in your living room for 10 hours. You got movies, you got food, you know, if you want to drink something, they're right there. They have service. They have places where you can go get stuff, like little survey bars. You know, so it's like 10 hours. Okay, it's not that bad. And then you get to where you're going. It takes more time to get through the airport than it does to fly anymore. You know, you got to go to the airport, you get a, you know, then you got to go through and then you got to get your bags and then you got to go through TSA and everybody, you know, take all your clothes off, put them all back on again, go in, wait. It takes more time to get to the airplane and then to get away from the airplane after you're done, you know, and leaving the airport takes more time to do that than it does to take a 10-hour flight. Anyway, I'm going off track here, but the point is that with very primitive technologies, you can have relatively simple aircraft. Then the next question is, how do you propel these aircraft? Well, we don't have indications of propellers or jet engines in those days, but what is available, and this is a point of my 2003, I gave a talk at the UFO Congress, and Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection book was released there. I did a book signing at that, and I gave a talk. I was one of the premier speakers at that. 1,200 people in attendance in the audience, and the whole back section was of NASA and military tier one level scientists come to listen to my talk. And when I'd give something like that, I would typically have people that came with me to sit out in the audience in those specific areas and listen to see what people were talking. And there was a lot of chatter going on, but I exposed the location of Atlantis. Afterwards, I had a physicist, like a Dr. Spock type of physicist from the fleet that was in Northern Australia, come up and talk to me. He goes, everything you're talking about here is correct. He told me. And he said, just keep doing what you're doing. We don't know how you figure out all this stuff you're doing, but just keep doing what you're doing. We have your back covered. And of course, I was always an independent scientist. And when these tier one scientists would come up and talk to me throughout my history, they would say the same thing. So we don't know how you figure all this stuff out. We have teams of physicists, the best ones in the world, working on these problems, and you figured out you don't have government money, you don't have a lab, you don't have any of this, these facilities that we have, and you're figuring this stuff out, and we can't. And anyway, it's pretty crazy. You know, and that's why when you listen to this radio show, you're not going to hear this on Joe Rogan or Tucker Carlson or any place else, you know, that suppose the top shows going, you're not going to hear this anyplace. You're not going to see it on YouTube. You're going to find out here on a show that I pay for my own airtime. I don't have sponsors. Good grief. Is this nuts or what? Okay. Back to the idea of what it takes to go into outer space. Outer space or just to fly. The propulsion systems I talk about in my Atlantis to Tesla book. And that was something that, remember, this is like 2003. In the early 1980s, I was in Los Angeles promoting my electromagnetic propulsion systems. And one of them is actually printed, the paper, the IEEE paper that was resulted from my work, giving a talk at these meetings, was finally presented in this book in 2003. I think the actual IEEE paper was from 1986, where I gave a talk at the 19th International Electric Propulsion Conference, was held in Boulder, Colorado. And at a hotel there, it was a very famous hotel, it's the Boardway, I forget. But anyway, it had big elk heads and forget the name of the hotel. It's live radio. Sometimes you don't remember things. You know, that was 1986, a little while ago. But anyway, I gave a talk on electromagnetic propulsion systems. And to build this propulsion system, all you need is glass and wire. And so very simple. And it pushes against the Earth's magnetic field. And so anyway, the flying carpets would be easily built with a dirigible type of frame, airframe. And then basically that means that most of the energy expended today, let me put it this way, most of the energy expended today in an aircraft, like a jet or a prop plane, is to keep it up. So you have the airfoils, which have a 10-to-1 advantage over a flat board for a wing. You have the airfoils so that once you get going fast enough, that vacuum basically on the top of the wing lifts it up and keeps you airborne. But if you have a dirigible, you don't need that. All you need to do is overcome the friction, which is very small compared to the amount of energy that it takes to keep the thing up there. So a dirigible takes very, very little energy to move it, especially if you're at low velocities, like the Hindenburg and the Zeppelins, the Zeppelin-manufactured aircraft. And so it takes very little energy, and so the so-called flying carpet is something that you could easily build in your backyard if you had technology for glass, metal, the soft metals. I'm talking about aluminum, copper, gold, and some of the other softer metals. By the way, what I learned, one of the things I learned from the wind energy business is steel is sometimes used because it has a very high melting point. It's not a great conductor, but because it has a very high melting point, it can be used for very high current cabling. So at any rate, that's another, refined steel where you have iron ore. Iron ore in its natural state is oxidized, is red. And so to create the steel, you have to get the oxygen out of there. And that's what the smelting does. Okay, so at any rate, getting back to the main theme here, what does it take to build an aircraft, really, if you only have primitive tools? Well, the most primitive one would be like a hot air balloon. You have a basket hanging down below. You have a source of heat, which typically today they use propane, a propane tank. And that creates hot air, and you fill up this big balloon full of hot air. And because it is lighter than air, that's one way to look at it, it'll move up in the air, just like a bubble in the ocean moves up. The energy of the water collapsing below it forces the bubble up, the same way with a hot air balloon. The shape of the balloon is such that the air below it has a higher pressure, and it's like squirting it up. It goes up in the air. And then you can maintain the altitude with the by just turning on the gas flame, heating the air. Another way to do that would be to fill it with hydrogen or helium. But of course, then you would have to have it closed like a balloon. You have helium balloons that are used for weather. They go way up in the atmosphere to measure conditions, velocity, and other weather conditions high in the atmosphere. And there are records for people that have actually gone up in enclosed capsules with like weather balloon type of systems where they go way up there, like up in the atmosphere. And I don't know what the current records are for that. But these are very simple ways of having performing flight, getting off the ground and moving from one place to the other. Okay, so just in summary, it is very easy to, with very primitive forms of building craft, to have something that flies. And of course, today, everything is very complicated. It seems like modern man effort to build things always nullifies the simplistic, ignores the simplistic. The things that would be obvious to somebody if you did not have, electronics or printed circuit boards. Just imagine just a private plane today, a very simple private plane, has all kinds of things in it that really are not necessary for flight. You have the fixed wings, you have the airfoils, you have a propeller, a great big engine of some kind, There's many different designs of powerful engines. In World War II, they had these massive water-cooled engines that powered high-performance fighter planes, etc. Then, of course, they went to jet engines. And this is what people think of when they think of flight. They don't think of very simplistic forms of flight that could have been obtained by primitive people. And I'm not saying the Atlanteans were primitive. They just did, you know, they did not need printed circuit boards to fly. And they had the ability, I believe, to go into outer space. Because there was a certain point, and this is something you can take to the bank as true, there was life on Mars. Mars was a blue planet, just like Earth. It had an atmosphere, it had oceans, it had rivers, it had weather systems, and it had people. And that is something that is very clear. I've studied this topic. I've read about the different things that indicate that there were people on Mars. And when Venus, the comet, came by, it took off the atmosphere and oceans of Mars. And so, and I talk about that in my books. I'm not going to go through that again. But just briefly, Venus, the comet, had a surface gravity that was higher than that of Mars. And so when the electrical connection occurred, Venus won the tug of war and literally pulled the oceans and atmosphere off of Mars in a single night. Earth has had this happen to it multiple times throughout its history. And so then what happens? It starts rebuilding its atmosphere. Mars currently is rebuilding its atmosphere. And, you know, maybe in a few million years, it will be a water planet again. It's in that zone. The idea that people are looking for the source of water on Mars. Well, it left. It all left. And it's very obvious that it was recent because it has pristine riverbeds carved into the surface of Mars. It has all of the characteristics of recent water activity, erosion, etc. I was in an American Geophysical Union meeting once, and I went into one of the talks early, and there were some geologists there from NASA, and they knew who I was. They recognized me, and they were talking amongst themselves, and they were showing photographs of Mars that showed recent water erosion in rocks on Mars. And these are guys, these are geologists. And they said that they could not publish their work. It was not allowed to be published because it showed recent water activity. Only, if you were at NASA, you could only talk about water being billions of years ago on Mars. And here's two guys with clear evidence, trained geologists who see this kind of water erosion on Earth, showing that it's recent, and the difference between recent and ancient, and they said they could not publish it because, you know, they were simply weren't allowed to talk and give their opinion, which is standard in science and medicine, all kinds of things today. Okay, switching gears just a little bit here. This was discovered a number of years ago, but I'm just going to make a quick announcement about this. There is a cave in it's a place called Naica, N-A-I-C-A, interestingly enough, very close to the name Nazca, only one letter difference. Naica, New Mexico, N-A-I-C-A. Nazca is spelled N-A-Z-C-A, so, interesting. Very similar names. But anyway, there's a cave system there, and they were mining. I think they were going after precious metals and precious gems in this mine, 1,000 feet underground. And you just got to wonder, how do these people discover this? Who actually goes down and digs around and finds these locations? But anyway, they discovered a mine, and they went through this mine wall, and they discovered a cave of crystals, quartz crystals. Now, one of my favorite possessions that I don't have very many keepsakes, but this was from when I lived in Mexico when I was young. And there was an area in Mexico. Mexico has lots of minerals. It's very mineral rich. But there was an area where there were these quartz caves. And I had this big quartz crystal, maybe 9 inches long, beautiful quartz crystal. And these form over millions of years as water drips into a cave area, and the crystals build up over time. Well, the cave in Nica, New Mexico, 1,000 feet underground, had crystal quartz crystals that were big enough for people to walk on them. They were like 10 feet long. Gigantic quartz crystals, which would have taken millions of years to develop. But the thing is, they needed an active source of water, which, of course, was not there at the time underground. So these were formed near the surface of Earth. And then over time, dirt built up. And that, you got to wonder, where's all this dirt coming from? It's literally coming in from outer space. As Earth acts as a comet, discharging the solar capacitor, slowly taking on water and material, whatever's in space, would be ionized and come in and slowly building up a layer. So we find oil reserves that are 18 miles down. 1,000 feet isn't even a fifth of a mile. And so 18 miles down, they're finding oil reserves. So these oil reserves had to be at the surface of the Earth at some point in Earth's history. And so it's really bizarre today. This mantra that comes out of NASA and standard astronomy that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, and everybody repeats it like it's some kind of gospel truth. Absolutely absurd. Because what do? They pick up a rock up on the surface of the Earth. They go, oh, they make a couple of estimates based on radiocarbon dating or something. And then they go, oh, 4.5 billion years old, or something falls in from the sky and they look at it. And, oh, 4.5 billion years old. And so they just repeat this. Nothing, none of this has anything to do with the age of the Earth. Nothing. The same thing with the moon. They have moon rocks. The rocks that they brought back from the moon, and by the way, many countries now have picked up things from the moon and brought them back. Specifically, the United States and Russia. And Russia never landed a man on the moon. You don't need men to bring rocks back from the moon. But they did the same thing. The rocks on the surface of the moon have nothing to do with the interior of the moon. It's stuff that fell from outer space. So how can you say that has something to do with dating the moon? It's the assumption proves the assumption. You assume that the universe is 4.5 billion years old, and then you prove it by picking up a rock on the surface and then saying that that dates to 4.5 billion years ago. Therefore, that's the date of the planet. The moon, our planet, whatever. Absolutely ridiculous science. So the age of the Earth, the point here, is the age of the Earth is probably much, much, much more than 4.5 billion years. But there's no way of discussing it because, you know, it's one of those things like Lyndon Johnson, one of the biggest crooks that ever walked into the presidency. Once he said, you repeat something enough times, people begin to think it's the truth. And that's a technique of anything. You simply repeat it and repeat it and repeat it. And maybe you even start believing it, even though there's no factual basis for whatever it is. Okay. So at any rate, the cave in New Mexico, of course, is just one other enigma that there's no explanation for it in standard science. Just a quick mention here before I forget. The MR5 whole house water filter is on sale. It's $350 off. The best deal package where you get the MR5 and the UV sterilizer in a package. You get two bulbs. They last a year each for the UV sterilizer. And then the MR5 comes with its initial set of filters. And typically that price is $2,100. Right now it's on sale for $350 off, $1,750. And you can use the coupon code JMCC to get another 5% off. So anyway, go to the webpage, JMCC Water Filters, Or you can also get there from my main webpage, jmccsci.com, where you'll find all my books, CDs, DVDs, and they're all available now as e-products where you can download them instantly upon purchase. And, of course, the prices are very good because they're downloadable. We don't have to store them in a warehouse or print them or ship them out or pay for the mailing, all of those things. And so, once again, the webpage for the water filters, jmccwaterfilters.com, and the main webpage where you can get to everything else, including the grow towers, the wind energy systems, everything, the water filters, jmccsci.com. Okay. A quick mention here about, this was an interesting little clip that I saw, that a guy was talking about his survival cabin, and I think it was in the Carolinas, where he had built this back out in the woods, stocked it up with food, got everything ready for his, survival cabin, so to speak, and they showed a picture of it. It was a rustic little cabin. You could tell handmade, probably made a lot of local materials, logs and timbers, etc., locally. So anyway, but then what he decided is that that was not a very good plan. So he gets, something happens, there's some kind of event, man-made or natural event, and he goes to his cabin to live. So he's there by himself. It's like, whoa, this is not a very good plan. And so he decided what you need is a community. And, just maybe two people, like the pioneers, that was pretty rough. You can imagine people like Daniel Boone or Davy Crockett going out into the wilderness, and they're with their wife and maybe a couple of kids, and they got an axe and maybe a cow or something like that, and they're trying to survive just by themselves. And very soon they formed a big sense of community, something that has been totally lost in the United States, because everybody says, oh, I don't need this other group of people, or women say they don't need men, and men, I don't know, whatever, Everybody's independent today because you can go to the grocery store, buy your food, you can, earn your money, whatever, and you don't need other people. You can live in your apartment all by yourself. It's amazing. People that live in big cities are some of the loneliest people on the planet because other people just don't talk to you. You live with all these people and nobody even talks to each other, whereas in a community out in the countryside, like where I grew up, everybody depends a little bit on everybody else, and you communicate with everybody. You kind of like know everybody. Everybody knows everybody. And it can be a little bit of a problem if you have some gossipy people. But no, the idea is that you have a community. And a community needs people with various types of personalities. And you need that support. If somebody is not feeling good, okay, they take care of the kids. One of the first things they did when the pilgrims came to the United States was to form schools. The first thing they did, because they needed one person to take care of all the kids for the majority of the day. Then all the other people can go and get stuff done. If you got the kids there all day, two, three, four kids, they take up all your time. Nothing happens. So you got to take care of the kids. So schools were one of the very first things that were developed in the history of any community. So you get that out of the way, but you need a community. You need people that are skilled in some things, other people are skilled in other things. And the Amish are really good at this. They have maintained that community, that sense of community where everybody is needed. When you're young, you grow up helping. You're out there with the men working, learning what's going on, how do you do this stuff. And what's the main thing they do is they provide their food and shelter and everything they need with just local the local resources. One time I was in, this was in Iowa, I'm driving through Iowa, and I came across, there were two young ladies there, and they were selling strawberries. And so anyway, I stopped, bought some strawberries, and they were Amish. And so I said, can I go to where your farm is? I'd like to go see it and talk to the people. So anyway, yeah, they just right down the road. So I go there, And I drive in, and the lady was nice enough to show me around, to show me the work shed and the tool shed and the different places where they. And I said, "Look, I have my books. I can send you books." She said, "Okay, but nothing electronic. No discs, no videos, nothing electronic." So I did. I got back to where I was going, and I sent them my whole set of books, printed books, you know. And so at any rate, I never heard back or anything. But interesting that they, and when I was there, they had students in a classroom. I could see through the window that the students were there, and there was a teacher there. And I could see the men out in the fields working. But they are the most successful people. What they do is they take their profit from their sales of their food that they grow, in addition to everything that they grow for themselves, and they sell it, and they take that money and they buy more land. Then they can grow, and they have a and they, if you look at a map where the Amish live and control the areas, it's huge. These people have grown is because they have a method where they work together. And that's one of the big problems with American families, is everybody's off doing their own thing. Everybody's got to pay for their own house, their own apartment, everything. And they don't, they're not communal. One of the things you see from, especially people that remember back in the days when the Vietnam War, the Laotians, the Vietnamese, there were Chinese coming in, Japanese. And what do? They have a communal lifestyle. And they would save their money, and they would pick, you know, the head of the family would pick one kid that was the brightest, the sharpest, to go to college. And everybody would contribute, because that person going to college was better than none of them going to college. And that person would get an education and then help the other ones. So anyway, that communal spirit has been totally lost. But that's what this guy was talking about. He built his cabin, set it up for survival, had everything he needed, and then realized, hey, this is no good. This doesn't work. Okay, another announcement here. The Boeing Starliner. It's like every week I announce this again. The Boeing Starliner launch has been postponed again. I think it's into June now. And it's really not good to have a spacecraft just sitting out in the weather. They have to fill these with gas and then unload them. And then they have issues with leaks. Apparently there's a helium leak up on the main, the space capsule where the astronauts go. They've had this thing on the launch pad ready to go and canceled in the last few minutes. Somebody asked me to make a comment about the severe weather that's all over the place. Is it manipulated? I don't know, but the news media is sure plugging it. Anyway, I'm out of time. I'll talk to you next week. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.